never really wanted to be a CEO because I'm a scientist, but I am now. And we're focusing on hepatitis B and trying to create the curative regimens for hepatitis B. There's 250 million people in the world with hepatitis B. So if I could do that, I'd be very happy, or at least help contribute to that, I'd be happy. That's the goal.
The Born Global Coffee Pod series is powered by Advance, the professional network for overseas Australians, fueling change at home and around the world. When Aussies step out of their comfort zone and drive ideas, talent and ambition internationally, I don't know about you, but I feel a sense of irrepressible optimism. Through the 2021 Advance series, I'm going to introduce you to the next household names, triggering the waves of change that are breaking upon our shores down under. What makes so many Aussies take their ingenuity, hope and grit to faraway places? How can we celebrate and support them more readily? And who are these global success stories when they're at home? At a time when leadership can feel in turmoil, let's lift ourselves and future generations up with stories of Aussies born global, with the courage to become the change the world needs.
Allow me to introduce Dr. John McCutchinson AO, the Advance Global Impact Award winner for 2020. Dr. McCutchinson has played a central and critical role in developing the curative treatments for hepatitis C. To develop this treatment is a remarkable accomplishment destined to improve the health of many millions of people. John's work has seen him develop not only antiviral drug combinations, but also a more broad spectrum anti-HCV drug that collectively cures nearly every patient infected with HCV. Just remarkable. This represents a 30-year personal investment in understanding the disease. Dr. McCutchinson joined Assembly Bio, where he now works as Chief Executive Officer and President in 2019, and has firmly turned his sights to curing HBV, or hepatitis B, of which there are 250 million infected people worldwide. Let's get into our conversation.
Dr. John McCutchinson, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for making the time. I'm interested with the world that you operate in and the myriad of topics you're looking at, scientific breakthroughs you're tracking. What's top of mind for you right now?
I think science is extraordinary right now. The leaps in technology have allowed so many things to move forward so rapidly beyond what we could have even possibly comprehended in terms of therapies for patients, which is my focus, but that leads into basic science. So I think gene therapy and gene editing to treat previously rare but untreatable diseases is really starting to have some traction. And people with these rare diseases, Duchenne's muscular dystrophies, various different neurological conditions, cystic fibrosis, these sort of diseases are really pushing forward. I think the vaccine work that's been done this year shows the power of science in being able to just scale up within a year and create millions of doses for a vaccine with a messenger RNA or an mRNA technology that's never been tried before, really. I mean, that's extraordinary. And then I believe the underpinnings of biology for other diseases is just opening up our ability to understand large data sets, understand diseases, understand complex biological diseases. I'm working on hepatitis B, that's one, for example, which I think we'll be able to cure one day. There's 250 million people. But these sort of diseases and our approach from data, from new experiments, from new technologies, single cell transcriptomics, being able to look within a single cell in somebody's organ with a disease and dissect that individual cell and determine how you could interrogate that and interfere with something to make a disease better. These things are all really extraordinary. I've given you a sort of long answer, but I'm so enthusiastic about everything. And some of these areas that we are working on are truly dramatic. Now, whether we can move gene editing from and gene therapy from rare diseases to common diseases, you know, that would be another extraordinary hallmark or something that we could potentially come up with in the future. Anyway, they're my initial thoughts on that. The future is bright.
Your enthusiasm. The future does.
Look, the future is bright for medicine and therapies, and once we've been able to do that, then, you know, we've got to implement and deliver them at a reasonable cost to the people that need them. That's a separate issue. That's not so much science, that's policy, right?
Yeah, but it's a very important hand-in-hand relationship, isn't it, in terms of being able to move the dial on, as you mentioned, with Hep B, you know, a disease that affects 250 million people worldwide.
Right. And look, Hep C, in my previous job at another company, we developed, as others have, curative treatments for hepatitis C. You can take a pill, one pill a day for 8 or 12 weeks, and that'll cure 95% of people or more with hepatitis C. There's 71 million people in the world, approximately, with Hep C. We've developed those therapies now for over 6 years. They've been available. We've only treated and cured about 2 million or 2.5 million. So there's, you know, 68, 69 million to go. So how do you implement that these medicines can be delivered throughout Africa and through other underdeveloped or less fortunate parts of the world? We did a great thing with Australia, actually. We gave a huge discount to the Australian government for these medicines, and the Australian government was smart enough to put the resources into realizing that they could do this. And I think Australia will be one of the first companies that can eliminate and completely control hepatitis C because of this sort of action that the government saw that they needed to take.
That's an awesome example of the scientific and medical community working hand in hand with policymakers. I love hearing that. It doesn't always happen, does it? And you know, you mentioned you're currently working on Hep B. In a former life, you're working on Hep C. How do you end up in that area of specialization? How did they become the diseases you're pursuing solutions to?
Well, so I trained in Melbourne at Melbourne Uni, and I went to med school and worked at the hospital, Royal Melbourne there, and there was a guy there who, a very famous guy called Ian Mackay, who was at the WEHI. And Ian was an immunologist and probably the first translational scientist there was before there was the term coined translational scientist. So he had a ward 3 East, I think it was, in the hospital, where there were all these young people with strange autoimmune diseases, lupus and autoimmune hepatitis as a form of liver disease. So Ian was an immunologist. He had a great mind, inquiring mind. Why is this happening? Why are we observing this? Let's take it back to the lab. And he got me very interested in liver disease. So then I trained in gastroenterology and liver diseases. And then I came to America to undertake further training in the late 80s. Went to this famous liver unit at University of Southern California and worked with two doyens in the field, Pete Reynolds and Al Redeker. Actually, Al Redeker died today, a week ago, which is sort of sad for me, but these guys were extraordinary, and Al Redeker took me into his office one day. He was the hepatitis guy and said, there's this guy in San Francisco. I want you to go and visit him. He thinks he's discovered this virus called Hep C. So he flew me up to meet Mike Houghton, and Mike Houghton discovered hepatitis C. The paper was written, and I started all my research with Mike Houghton and with Al Redeker at USC then.
And what year was the disease discovered? What year are we talking about?
The paper was written in 1989, if I recall correctly, the discovery of hepatitis C. Mike Houghton received the Nobel Prize for that very recently, along with two others. We're still friends. He still lives here in Northern California. Extraordinary man. And this field just sort of exploded into understanding this virus that was infecting hepatitis C, that was infecting 1% of the world's population. And why was it doing that? How was it doing it? How is it transmitted? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that was the start of my career. I never went home.
You've been in America ever since. I need to hear about this $11 billion bet you made, though. That feels very significant in the context of your pursuit of solutions to Hep C in particular.
So I spent 20 years at Duke. I was at Scripps, USC Scripps, and then Duke, and I was in academia, and we were working on treatments, and there were treatments that weren't curing very many people, and they were hard to take in injections and so forth. So the field was moving in this direction, and we'd made some inroads. I'd developed with a company called Vertex in Boston, helped them develop a drug that was a protease inhibitor, which is a key enzyme that the virus needed to replicate. And I was running their trials all around the world with them, and was a breakthrough. It was an oral drug. It was given with interferon injections and another drug, but we were starting to cure significant numbers of people, 50, 60% in some of the trials. So that was all work done in academia. And then there was a company called Gilead that was a very powerful and effective antiviral company based in San Francisco, run by a nucleic acid chemist who was the CEO called John Martin. And I got a phone call from John Martin's CSO, Norbert, saying, would you like to come and talk to us about hepatitis C? And I thought, oh, it's an honour, and just go out to talk to them on hepatitis C. And they were recruiting me to come and run their programs to try and cure hepatitis C. So John Martin said, come and work with us, help us cure hepatitis C. We need somebody like you. So I was recruited to come and work for them and come and help us cure hepatitis C. We did. We knew it was going to take multiple drugs, multiple different mechanisms, non-overlapping approaches to attack the virus. And we had many of those mechanisms. Gilead had been working on many of those mechanisms for years before I arrived, but there was one key mechanism and a critical mechanism called a nucleotide analog, nucleoside analog, and we didn't have that. But it was in a small company called Pharmacet, which was based in North Carolina. I was one of their senior advisors when I was at Duke. And their drug looked very good and safe, safe and effective. It has to be safe and effective if you're going to treat millions of people. So we bought Pharmacet after about a 15-month period of time, interacting with the company and the board and our management. It was an extraordinary period of time. It was $11 billion. Our market cap then was $33 billion. So the CEO bet a third of the company on that drug that was in phase two in 100 patients. And we were quite criticized for that, but that drug became the backbone of all of our subsequent curative regimens that we developed in record time then. We had four different multi-combinational products approved that in essence then cured every strain of the virus, one pill taken for 8 or 12 weeks, including people with cirrhosis and actually even taking the pill now. You can now take an organ. Somebody needs a liver transplant. You can take an organ from somebody that has hepatitis C, a donor, put it into a patient who requires a liver transplant, give them these medicines, and that organ won't become reinfected with hepatitis C. So it's been an extraordinary revolution for a disease, really. So we can now effectively cure everybody with that disease if we can get the medicines to them at the appropriate price and implement the policies that are required to do that. So that's the challenge for the field now. Other companies have developed drugs as well, of course, now. So it's not just one company. And multiple drugs, multiple companies are approaching this now, has driven the price down through competition. And then, you know, people like the Australian government invested a lot. They came, had a deal with our company back then, Gilead, to purchase a large amount of drugs at a great discount. But the premise of Australia was that we could treat everybody who was infected in the company and then eliminate or completely control this disease. And through GPs and through the national health system and so forth. And Australia is doing an extraordinary job of doing that and is likely to become one of the first westernised countries to be able to do that and to say effectively we've sort of suppressed this disease. And it's been a pleasure to be part of it, as have many thousands of others been part of it as well.
It's a great collaborative effort, isn't it, in terms of the way that the scientific community moves forward and shares research and piggybacks on one another. I think it's a great, I guess, approach to problem solving in many ways that probably more sectors could be learning from. And I wanted to pick that up a little bit with you because you described yourself earlier to me as an unlikely and somewhat reluctant CEO. And I was interested for your opinion on whether we need more academics in CEO roles and perhaps what the greatest challenge coming into a CEO role as an academic with an academic brain is and what the greatest strength is.
You know, once a scientist, always a scientist, right, Holly? So I never really wanted to be a CEO. Anyway, I'm doing that now and I love it, I must say. But the challenge is that, like you just said, collaboration in science is important. You must always collaborate with the best people. And when you're a CEO or a leader of a company, you have to find the right people and you need to work with them and lead them. So I think in science, in pharma, in biotech, I think, and Elon Musk said this recently, you need more people that don't have MBAs running companies. You need more people who are passionate, who have vision, who know what they want to do. You know, we wanted to cure Hep C. We knew what we had to do. We stayed focused on that. We're now trying to do that with Hep B. And I will be absolutely critical on the focus and what we need to do and keep that big picture in mind. It's very easy to get distracted. So anyway, I think having the right people and having more people who are passionate and understand deeply about something, leading organizations, be it in our industry or some other industry, is very important. So, yeah, I think these are the principles by which it should be. I think John Martin, the CEO of Gilead, was really one of the last true scientists to be CEO of a large biotech small pharma company. You know, there's not that many of them now. They're all being run by people with other, you know, business degrees and so forth, because it's a large part of the organization to create shareholder value, right? But I think there should be more of it, and I love it, and I'm learning a lot. You know, the challenge for a scientist or somebody, the challenge for anybody really, is you tend to want to stick with what you're good at, right? It's comfort. It's easy for me to go and talk to the scientists in the company all the time. I could spend all day doing that, but I got to speak to HR, I got to speak to the CFO, I got to speak to the head lawyer. You know, these are the things that I'm learning about. The investors, Wall Street, we're a public company. So you have to wear many hats and juggle many hats. So you have to embrace it. You have to want to learn and get outside your comfort zone. So I enjoy doing it.
Now, I don't necessarily want to suggest that this might be the trajectory you take it in, but that piece around comfort zone intrigues me. And I know you've got 5 kids. And I'm intrigued if you could kind of boil down your career and everything that you've learned over your journey to date into a handful of lessons. What do you hope to impart on your kids, the next generation coming through, as kind of sound pearls of wisdom?
So I've always said to my kids, and I think in the company and more generally to people who are starting off in some direction, you have to be passionate about something. You really should spend a lot of time thinking about what you want to do because you're passionate about it. And I've always said I'm passionate about what I do. I have a hobby, not a job. I've never asked for a promotion. I've never asked for a title. I've never asked for a salary increase or anything. It just comes along the way because you're passionate about what you do, and it comes across, and you end up being good at it if you work hard. 95% hard work, 5% the other bits and pieces, I think. So being passionate about something and really thinking about that and sorting it out and doing things that you want to do for the right reason, you have to always ask yourself why. Why is this happening? As a scientist, why is this observation occurring? If you don't inquire deeply about things in science, you'll never understand it and you'll never get the right answer. So I think those things, that's very good and very, very important. And then collaborating, you have to collaborate. You know, science, any field of business or science, it isn't an individual. It's a team of people who strive to make the greatest advances, particularly in terms of therapeutics for humans and other forms of science as well. So you must be very careful and be open about collaboration, not have this closed mind that you're the best and you understand it better than anybody else. So this is a very important thing I always tell my kids as well. Always work with others. Always think about who you should work with. Who do you work with well and why? And why are they what are they adding and what are you adding and so forth? And then the other thing I think is just, for me at least anyway, has I've always been, Holly, very transparent, very honest with myself, critically honest with myself and with everybody else, maybe too much so, some would say, along the way. And, I think that keeps you on the straight and narrow and gets you to the right answer. following your gut is part of that as well. Your gut instinct is about being truthful to yourself and not wavering about things. So again, it comes back to focus.
Truthful there. And you, I watched a really great address that you gave to Melbourne University graduates a few years ago. And one of the things you encouraged them to do, as I think all scientists resonate with, is this notion of pursuing truth. And I wanted to ask you about truth, because one of the things we often characterize this time that we're in is misinformation, alternative fact, all these new phrases and ideas. Do you think the pursuit of truth has become harder? And how do you think, you know, the relationship between science and perhaps the broader world is sitting right now? Because some do describe this period as being a little bit of a war on science. I do wonder if the pandemic has changed that a little bit, but I'd be interested for your observations around truth.
I think it is challenged right now in science. I think this interaction with the last our last government here and their interactions with the FDA around the truth and the task force and what information was being put forward publicly was clearly not the truth always and misleading. I don't want to get political here, but I think there was a challenge here, and the FDA's role in being the great regulator and looking after the public and making things were safe was also somewhat challenged by pressures that were put upon them. So my answer to your question is that, yes, I think the system has been challenged, but I think it's resilient and it's survived, and the FDA is held in high regard and has done the right thing. And I think all of those things are very important. I think as a scientist, it's also truth at a lower level internally. It's truth. It's very easy to convince yourself that an experiment's leading you in the right direction than the wrong direction. So my comment to the students at the university was to make sure you're not fooling yourself, that you think you know what's true and what's not true as well at a sort of lower level. So I think it hits all levels of science from the top to the bottom. It's a long and winded answer, but I do believe our system is robust. I do believe we've done a good job in the last year and a half with coronavirus and acceleration of things despite great political pressures. The scientific system has survived and done a really good job.
You've mentioned that to me that you are now have been outside of Australia longer than you've been in it. I'm intrigued for whether you miss home at all. And I guess what I'd be interested in your observations as an Australian working abroad. What about kind of the Aussie character and what you grew up with in terms of the traits that are characteristic do you think's held you in good stead? And what about the world that you've spent most of your working life in this case the USA, do you wish you could sprinkle a little bit more of in Australia?
Somebody described me in a book as laconic or something. That's an Australian characteristic, I think.
That's very Australian.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, I think my ability to be just very forthright, I think Australians are forthright in general.
You're quite blunt, you know, aren't we?
Yeah, blunt, forthright. You wear your emotions on your sleeve. You tell people what you think. It's okay in Australia, right? It's not so okay in America, right? It's not always like that, particularly in the South, where I spent 10 years in North Carolina. I probably shouldn't have said that if this is going to be good. But there are different parts of the world where it's much more formal, and I think that's helped me here scientifically. And maybe I've had some latitude by being Australian and being able to be forthright about things and honest about things, which people have really, over the time, acknowledged and liked about me, I think. I'm very straightforward, a bit impatient, need to get to the bottom of things, and that's an Australian characteristic. I think Australia still has a bit of a tall poppy syndrome as well. So I think the colloquialism of working in Australia and working globally, I think, could be brought together a little bit better, if I could say that. I think I've had some opportunity over the years to look at potential opportunities to come back home. And the one reason I probably never came home was things were really exciting here, Holly, but there was a sense of insularism to me and an inability for the country to work together more broadly. I thought Australia had enormous opportunities if we leveraged everybody in Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, et cetera, came together as an Australia-wide network for certain aspects of science. We could do extraordinarily well and be a real world leader. But that's quite difficult to do in Australia.
By virtue of the tyranny of distance, or are there other barriers that prevent that greater level of
collaboration? There's barriers between the states and the different institutions working more closely together, I think. That would be my observation. So
that's something to put on the to-do list for us moving forward then. I wanted to ask you, based on your experience, what's one action you'd like to encourage everyone who's listened to our conversation today to start doing in order to be a better leader? We've touched on a lot of different topics. If you could boil it down into one take forward, what would you like to encourage people to do?
We've talked about a lot of things: truth, honesty, collaboration, etc. I think another important thing that I was taught that I think has been very helpful as a leader, I think a leader in any field, science or elsewhere, is you should judge yourself by the success of those that work underneath you. So I had a boss previously at Duke who said to me, "I'm not judging you by what you do or what you write or how successful you are. I'll judge you by those who report to you, and you need to show me how effective they are." And that was a real, that was a long time ago for me, but that made me become a very good leader because it was my job to grow those underneath me. And the strength of a leader's organization is not by how strong the leader is, but by those who are underneath the leader as well. So I think it's an interesting way of thinking about your own performance and your own success, really. Judge those underneath you and critically think about that. So I do that a lot, actually.
That's brilliant. I love that philosophy because I don't think we often consider the succession plan and the level to which we raise up those around us, beneath us, you know, whatever way you want to look at a hierarchy, enough. So I think that's a really great pill of wisdom you got offered early.
Yeah, and if you surround yourself by excellent people and you do that, then your organization is going to be stronger and your success is going to be better as well, right? Everybody will do well, the company will do well, you'll make the scientific discoveries or whatever it might be. You know, the other interesting thing that same guy who's a big basketball fan in North Carolina, Duke basketball.
All basketball fans there, aren't they?
Yeah. It's the best sport in the world, I think. Oh, I shouldn't say that to somebody from Melbourne, but it is.
I would argue that with you, but we'll leave that for another day.
It is a great sport. And he said to me, "John, you know, when you've got a big organization," he said, "it's like a basketball team." He said, "you need to know everything about each one of those players." He said, "and you don't want 10 Michael Jordans. You know, you have to understand the strengths and weaknesses of each of those individual players on your team and meld them together, and then you know when to bring them in and out." And it was a very, very sort of impactful way of me to think about people and organizations. And I think once you start to think about things like that as well, it does help you build an organization to be ultimately most successful.
It changes the dimension that you're looking at things through, isn't it? You're thinking about that complementarity of people and how they play together as a team, as opposed to trying to find all these, to your point, you know, absolute stars who are going to play otherwise potentially a much more solo game, or perhaps not work as cohesively as you need everything to.
Yeah. Well, why is Jim not doing what I've asked him to? Or why can't Jim do what I asked him to do, or the way I want him to do it? Well, he's a different person. You have to understand him to get it out of him, or get somebody else to do it, and so forth. So, you know, it's this sort of thinking. It's fairly simple, but it's logical. And over the decades, it's certainly helped me a lot.
Well, Dr. John McCutcheon, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. I've taken a lot from this conversation and I've really enjoyed hearing your insights. And above everything, I want to thank you not only for your time today, but for the pioneering work that you're doing. Gives me a lot of hope that we have people like you at the forefront of pursuing things like Hep B, Hep C, that we're going to make an extraordinary amount more progress in the generation ahead. So thank you so much for your work and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you too, and I hope so as well. I think the future is bright for all of us.
Thanks for listening. I hope you're feeling fired up to be the change that you want to see in the world. I'd love to hear about the impact you're having. So hit me up on social and let me know what you're working on.
And if you've enjoyed the conversation, why not keep it alive and share it with someone in your world? I'm Holly Ransom. Let's grab a coffee again soon.